Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Could it be that not just Russia, which Trump wooed during the campaign, but also China, which he used as a foil, is happy about his election? Many China observers think so. James Fallows from The Atlantic, national correspondent for The Atlantic, has lived in China and written extensively about it, including in his books such as China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. And his latest story for The Atlantic is titled China's Great Leap Backwards, which discusses how the country has recently become more repressive, like in ways that have not been seen since the 1960s in China's context, and what this might mean for the United States. So we welcome James Fallows back to WNYC. Hi, James. Thanks for doing this.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Let me start here. This is not from your article, but I was speaking to a Chinese immigrant friend of mine yesterday who said China was very much for Trump during the campaign and did what it could to promote a Trump victory, including the funding of Trump for President airplane banners flown over some areas. And she showed me a photo. Do you agree China would have been for Trump, the Chinese government?
I think the Chinese government, in a cynical way, yes. I think, you know, the Russian situation is a whole case of its own in whatever ways they may or may not have been involved in the election. But I think the Chinese government, there's a medium cynical and a maximally cynical way in which they'd be for Trump. The medium cynical way is that in Donald Trump, Xi Jinping recognizes somebody he can, you know, feel some bond with. They're similar kind of leaders, similar kind of bombast and powerful personality and all of that. The deeply cynical way is I think that the Chinese government is sophisticated enough about the United States to believe that what Trump is trying to do will weaken the U.S., probably domestically and certainly internationally. So in terms of China's relative power to the U.S. around the world, I think they view this as being in their favor.
That must drive Donald Trump crazy. I don't expect you to be in his head, but we keep hearing this as analysis, that the reason that Putin really wants Trump is not that he respects Trump. It's that he thinks a Trump presidency will weaken the United States. And now you're saying the same thing with respect to China. I wonder if Trump even gets that.
The evidence of Trump having that kind of arm's length perspective on himself is slight to non-existent, and you know it's so amusing about in Putin's case that you know Mike Morrell, the one time acting CIA director, pointed out that he thought that Putin, the former KGB agent, had very skillfully played Trump by recognizing that flattery was what he wanted most. So if Trump said, "Oh, how great and how brilliant," Putin said, "How great and how brilliant Trump was," Trump would think Putin was a great guy. The Chinese are not quite that sophisticated in U.S., getting inside U.S. politicians' heads, but I think they do, yes, have the sense that Trump is, in some ultimate way, bad for America and therefore good for them.
Huh. And listeners, our phones are open if you want to talk to James Fallows, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So in your story for The Atlantic, China's Great Leap Backward, you said that China needs to be high on the new president's priority list because an important assumption has changed. What is that assumption and how has it changed?
The assumption, which prevailed pretty much from Richard Nixon's time until Barack Obama's, despite administration, despite other differences, was that basically it was better for the United States if China prospered than if it did not, and that as China grew and developed, it would not become more democratic. That probably is not going to happen any time in the foreseeable future, but it would become more internationalized. It would become sort of less fractious in the world system, and so therefore it was in everybody's interest to continue the partnership with China and engagement rather than anything else. I think the both internal repression and external aggression of the past 3 years under Xi Jinping are making serious China people in the U.S. and the West think, do we need to adjust our assumptions and prepare for a more difficult China for the foreseeable future?
Morning Edition reported today that China has done some things just since the election like announced the settlement of a court case that will now allow Trump as a brand name to be used across China, and also setting up a kind of Chinese TPP, an Asian region trade proposal more favorable to China to fill the void of the collapsing trade deal the Obama administration negotiated among 12 countries. Do you know about the Trump brand case, first of all?
The whole question of brands within China is an entirely separate nightmare realm where you'll come across all these. So I don't know whether it was the real Trump brand. I don't know whether it had anything to do with the election. I know that these trade deals, on the other hand, are a 100% foreseeable result of the U.S. Sort of bipartisan turning away from the TPP. From the Asian perspective, the TPP was less important as an economic exercise than it was a quasi-NATO type, not strictly military, but diplomatic bonding of the United States with all the countries except China. So as this goes away, China is saying, okay, South Korea, you're not going to have the TPP with the U.S. How about this new deal with us? Okay, Indonesia, how about this new deal with us? And so the rules-based system for a new Asian trade model will be much more determined by China than by this long-negotiated TPP.
Yeah, and that's one of the arguments that Obama keeps making for the TPP. And he keeps saying it in many public appearances, though I don't know how many Americans' ears it actually lands on, which is that China is not part of the TPP, and that without it, China would have a much easier time setting the rules of trade. So, China with its size, Obama says, shouldn't just be able to dictate trade terms to the region for its own advantage that then also disadvantage the United States. Do you know any examples of those?
Yes. So for example, I'm thinking of the main American exporters. If you're any kind of agricultural exporter, like machine tools exporters, Boeing airplanes, supply chains for various U.S. Manufacturing products, that there are what the U.S. was hoping for was a rules-based system that across Asia would make state subsidies less attractive. And China is really subsidizing. It's not its currency so much that's the problem now, is big subsidies for its steelmakers and some others like that. And the U.S. was hoping to have a kind of rules regime with everybody else that would exclude these Chinese subsidized products. In the absence of that, China is going to be able to make more deals of its own for its own subsidized products and favorable relations to sell into the Chinese market for the South Koreans, for the Japanese, for the Malaysians, for the Singaporeans, as opposed to the U.S. So I think, across the board, it means disadvantages for the U.S. in dealing with the Asian market and preferential treatment instead for some of their Chinese rivals.
James Fallows from The Atlantic with his latest article, China's Great Leap Backward. And Gene in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gene.
Hello. Thank you. Yes, I'm a Chinese-born U.S. citizen. I think Trump's election is greatly favored by the Chinese government for two reasons. One is economic, because the sudden death of TPP will encourage increase China's economic dominance among Southeast Asia countries. And second, Clinton, in fact, is being viewed in China as more hawkish than any Republican presidential candidate that they could have. And with Trump, with all his rhetorics during the campaign, would, if it were carried out, would only benefit China, for example, on the South China Sea,
yes,
and where the islands are, and also with the dispute between the Chinese government and the Japanese island, Diaoyu Island. Yeah.
Right. So. Right. There are various disputes between China and other countries with respect to islands and territories in that region. Gene, thank you very much. Call us again. And this is part of your article, I see, James, where you write that the U.S. should choose its battles with China carefully, saying the seas around China have been the theater for some of China's most dramatic recent muscle flexing, and they may be the wrong place for highly publicized efforts to draw the line. What's the risk?
So the risk is, so let me first say that what Gene, the caller Gene said, I agree with. And it's the kind of thing that you hear all across Asia, the sentiments that Gene was saying. So I appreciate his saying that. The risk in the South China Sea is that, I quote Susan Shirk, who's a longtime China expert from UC San Diego, saying that it would be natural to think of the South China Sea as like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you have to draw this dramatic line and have a showdown. And most people in Asia think that would be a mistake because for China, this would be just an unendurable challenge right in their face. And what one wants to do in the long run is subtly change the terms of diplomacy and engagement and military positioning in the whole Asian theater in ways that make it less attractive for China to do things we don't like. I mean, it's already the case that compared to 2 or 3 years ago, the United States is much closer to every other nation in that realm, including Vietnam, including others that, with whom we have disagreements, because China has been so aggressive. So the frontal, in-your-face showdown has almost never worked historically with China and has the potential to escalate. The behind-the-scenes rearrangement of the furniture in ways that penalize them for stuff we don't like seems to be the wiser way to go.
And Trump is an in-your-face kind of guy and seems to be getting ready to surround himself with some in-your-face, quote-unquote, diplomats, like maybe Rudy Giuliani for Secretary of State. But on the other hand, I think that tell me if you think this is wrong. It strikes me that the Trump America First foreign policy approach would be basically to say, we don't really care if China dominates the islands in the South China Sea. It may not be right by our notions of right or wrong, given other people's claims to those islands and other people's interests, but this is not America's business, and this is not where we're going to spend any political or military or economic capital. Yeah?
It certainly is possible that will be a way he spins out his views. I mean, what is so – one of many things is so, I'll just say, problematic about this next age in American governance is you can imagine Trump saying – reaching almost any conclusion from the things he said so far. He could say what you've just posited, you know, let China be China. He could say we're not going to be pushed around this way.
Right.
We're going to show that we're still number one and
exactly.
America is still great.
With your knowledge of China, what would the argument against the America First approach be? Why shouldn't – probably a lot of Americans are saying, God, you know, the last thing we need to get is to get into a shooting war with China because we told Japan we would protect some islands. This has nothing to do with us.
Oh, sure. Nobody wants to be in a shooting war with China. And so I stipulate that from the get-go. And I think that is unlikely. I think the long-term argument, and my article was based on the idea that there would be some kind of long-term thinking administration in power. We'll
right.
see whether that comes to pass, is that
– Oh, you mean
better.
You wrote it before the election?
I certainly wrote it before the election. It was positioned – I didn't know who was going to win. Its premise is that we'd have some thought about our actual policy. We'll see whether that comes true, but that it's better for the U.S., even in its own self-interest, if Asia is neither number one at war with its own frictions, number two entirely Chinese-dominated, those are both things that would be worse, and it's also there are – you know, almost any – the Chinese and the American economies are essentially connected and integrated now. It's really impossible to set – it would be very, very self-harmful to try to cut ourselves off from there. So I think it's better for us, and we can do it with relatively limited cost, to maintain our diplomatic and military and economic and cultural presence there and sort of keep the status quo rather than let things just slide into a Chinese sphere of influence.
Jack in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with James Fallows. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Brian. Hi, James. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
James, in regard to your last point about the interconnectedness of the Chinese and American economies, in a very general sense, on a high government level and on a popular level, what do the Chinese people think about Trump's "we're bringing back jobs to America" stances? And do they, you know, it would seem that would be against their interests. Are they worried about it, or are they just kind of laughing in its face?
I think more the laughing in its face and laughing, comma, with tears in this sense. Trump acts as if the United States is the only country that has this problem of disappearing manufacturing jobs. In fact, every single country on earth has this problem, including China. China's going to lose something like a million steel and coal industry jobs this year. And the reason is, in every country, including the U.S., it's not mainly trade that is doing this. It's mainly automation. It's mainly the fact that the United States produces as much coal as it ever has right now, but with one-tenth as many miners. That's just happening every place around the world. So I think they say, yeah, good luck bringing those jobs back, and because they are trying to deal with their manufacturing job loss at just the same time. So I think anybody who has looked at actual industries thinks that 25 years ago, trade may have been the main driver of loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States. Right now, in the U.S. and every place, it's mainly automation and technology that's driving it.
So when Trump talks about a 45% tariff on China, if they don't do things to make it harder for American companies to locate jobs over there, you think that's all bluster?
I think that is all bluster, because I think every part, much as is building the wall and making Mexico pay for it and things like that, because every single manufacturing industry in the United States and every single exporting industry in the United States would come to Trump and say, what are you thinking? That this is there is not a way to build Apple iPhones in the United States within the next 10 years or so. There just is a worldwide sort of
why not? Let me play Trump supporter and ask, or Bernie supporter for that matter, and say why not?
So first, I would point out to the Bernie supporter or the Trump supporter that if you pay, let's say, $500 for an iPhone or whatever the cost is, I'm an Android guy, so I don't know. Let's say it's $500. It says made in China. Of that $500, only about 50 to 75 goes to anybody in China. That's for these lower wage assembly jobs of components that come. A lot of it goes to Apple itself. It goes to your retailer. It goes to the glass maker, which is American. It goes to chip makers, which are South Korean or Japanese or German. It goes to other kinds of component makers. There is a worldwide production base for these things that just exists. And much as, the extreme example is North Korea. North Korea can't will itself to have whole production of everything except rockets, apparently, and bombs. But there is this worldwide system in which parts from Korea and Germany and Kentucky and California are put together in southern China and come back to the U.S. And you can say you want to undo that, but it would have a lot of effects on everybody.
Sanjeev in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sanjeev.
Yeah, hi, and nice to join your call, and I'm a big listener of your program, and it's very informative.
Good to have you on.
And thank you, and I agree with the guest, and especially the China, the way, and Russia, both together, the way they look at America and American election is that they think America has weakened after this election, the democracy has weakened. We have not chosen a president which is not representing the most people around here. Even the thoughts process, even though Republicans went in and voted for him, most Republicans still don't agree to his policies, his way of working. So they all believe that U.S. has lost its democracy and democratic power. And that's what the main driver of their purpose is around Southeast Asia and Japan, Atlantic, and Africa, also on the European side.
With any cost, in your opinion, Sanjeev, or is that just their opinion?
No, actually, this is what I read about international news and the understanding of the political environment around. And this is actually my opinion. You can say that.
Yes. If that's their opinion, I assume that you're saying something that's accurate. But with what cost to the United States, if their analysis is true? Does it help China? Does it help India? Does it help those countries who are looking on and laughing at America getting weaker?
Actually, it doesn't help anyone because, as the guest has said, that we are so intertwined between each democracies and each the production and manufacturing. Then one person or one country really cannot affect, and it actually can basically disturb the whole distribution network and create some problems, and it will be all through the world.
Sanjeev, thank you very much. So today, James, Trump meets with the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe. It's his first foreign head of state meeting since being elected. Do you think Abe will try to talk Trump into or out of any particular China policies?
I think Abe is going to mainly saying what is going on here, because remember the most Japan-specific part of Trump's campaign was his sort of loose talk about how Japan should renuclearize, or that he'd be open-minded about that. The fact that Japan was the only country on which nuclear weapons have ever been used by the United States in 1945 is the central part of Japan's foreign policy consciousness. It's equivalent to the Holocaust and the imagery of Israel. It's equivalent to the Civil War in the United States. And so for Trump just to kind of roll this off, hey, maybe they should get nukes, is something that is of really serious importance to Japan. Just one other point. I think that around the world there has been, you know, people have always complained about the United States in this dominant position, but there was a sort of bedrock assumption that the United States would not do anything crazy. You know, the United States is sort of the adult in the room. And I think that assumption is being reexamined around the world right now.
Yeah. And with respect to just one last thing, global warming, we know that Trump has called it a Chinese hoax. And I think that gets a lot of press, but that he actually a long time ago walked back the Chinese part of that, but might still think it's a hoax, that if there's a serious thought behind that flippant term, it's that China uses concern over global warming to get deals from the United States that will weaken America's economic competitiveness vis-a-vis China in the world at large. Do you think that's a serious thought?
I was tempted to use a phrase that begins with croc, but that I better not use on the airwaves. So I'll simply say that is not a well-founded argument. And indeed, the most impressive international news of the last week was when Xi Jinping of China, the world's gross most emitting nation, a place whose main problem is this just toxic pollution in every city and county, when Xi Jinping said to Donald Trump, "Don't you dare back out of this climate pact."
Xi Jinping said that to Trump.
He didn't say it to his face, but yeah, he said it to the news. He said, Donald Trump better not back out of this climate pact. So to have the communist premier of China saying the world's survival depends on the U.S. not reneging on the pact that the Americans and the Chinese and the Russians and the Indians and everybody put together in Paris, I thought that was a quite startling moment. And I hope that Xi Jinping and the leaders of the rest of the world prevail on this, because it is Chinese and U.S. cooperation on climate is it's both the best aspect of the relationship right now and the main source of either hope or pessimism for the world on this front.
Well, to be continued, and a lot to be continued. James, I'll just leave you with one piece of gossip in case you haven't heard this yet. You can use this at cocktail parties in D.C. there, that as China enables the spread of the Trump brand in China now, according to that court ruling, I guess that's the difference between China and the Upper West Side, because some buildings called Trump Place around West 70th Street in Manhattan got permission to take the Trump signs off their buildings and did, in fact, dismantle them this week. You can find photos on the Internet. So I don't know if you knew about that.
I didn't know that part of it, and I'm a guy from California. I've never really thought of myself as a New Yorker, but right now I am as one with the Upper West Side.
Considering how most people on the Upper West Side voted, that must have felt really good. People chanting, "Not my president," can't actually make him their not president, but these folks were able to say, "I'm not your resident," and physically take down his name. So, okay.
Well, congratulations to New York.
James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. His latest article is called The Great Leap Backward. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A lot more to come. Stay with us.